This is the Voice of Literacy, where literacy researchers, teachers, principals, parents, and policymakers share and discuss how literacy research informs practice. Join the biweekly podcast and discussion forums. My name is Dr. Betsy Baker, Professor of Literacy Studies at the University of Missouri. This week we hear from Dr. Chris Gutierrez, Professor of Social Research Methodology at UCLA. She does research involving literacy in the third space. Welcome, Dr. Gutierrez.
Hi, Betsy.
First, tell us about yourself and how you got interested in literacy in a third space, and maybe tell us a little about what is third space.
Okay. Well, you know, Betsy, I always find it fascinating to think about how people's intellectual and personal histories and their trajectories often become so intertwined, and that certainly is the case, true in my own case. So I think I can say that reading and writing have always played a central role in my life. So some background. I grew up in a small mining town in Arizona on the same street as the public library. It was a tiny little town. So I grew up in the library from story hour when I was a little kid to doing research on that required term paper in high school. And so because I lived so close, my parents took us all the library activities. And we also had a lot of home literacy activities. My father would quiz us all on random words he discovered in the dictionary, and my mom would read a lot to us. In our research and in our teaching, we often privilege what's called the space where the teacher is, the official space. And we really pay very little attention, both empirically and curricularly, to what goes on at the same time at any given moment in those other spaces.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that's what we, Joanne Larson and Betsy Rimes and I, call the counterscript.
Uh-huh.
The kind of interaction and talk and behavior that students were doing that was not directly related to what was going on in the official space. And what we found was fascinating, that those spaces were not just simply kids resisting. They were really interesting, meaning-making spaces for students.
Hmm.
And we started to study those to find out more about how kids were making sense of learning and why certain environments weren't working. And that led us to pay attention to, all of a sudden, these moments where people were interacting differently, that language changed, the attention changed, and people started engaging in very different kinds of inquiry. And it was that space that we called the third space.
Based on your expertise with literacy in a third space, what are some of the implications for teachers?
I think I would add teachers and policymakers.
Okay.
One of the really important things, and I think one of the important dimensions of understanding what is a social critical literacy in the third space, is to ask people to rethink what counts as culture, to move away from the tendency to conceive of culture as a trait of an individual or a particular group, to avoid equating culture with race and ethnicity, and to start to think about culture as a noun, to think about culture as a verb, as in what people do, how people live culturally.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really important because I think conflating culture with race and ethnicity often leads to a kind of essentializing that isn't very productive.
Hmm.
You know, my good friend and colleague, Fred Erickson, had a great response to this issue when I had him read an article that I wrote about this with Barbara Rogoff, and he said, "Oh, I see, 100% of Mexicans do not hit piñatas 100% of the time." And this is really important, that as teachers, as administrators, as policymakers, and as researchers, we need to develop this binocular vision in which we can account for both regularity and variation in any group.
Hmm.
We can learn to say, this is what we know about the cohort that's useful. But then we need to make empirical and curricular, methodological and policy decisions based on what we know about the variance within a group, right? Because there's more variance within groups than across groups. This is just fundamental to really moving away from these broad brushstroke notions of literacy and the kinds of programs that have been developed, especially for students from non-dominant communities, that I think is essential.
Yeah.
We're going to start thinking about the possibilities for students from non-dominant communities in this country.
And so in your essay in Reading Research Quarterly, you argue for a paradigm shift in what counts as learning and literacy education for youth. What do you mean by that? Can you explain that?
Yes. Generally, and my work has really been with almost exclusively with what I call non-dominant students. Students, the terms minority, et cetera, just don't work. And what we were interested, by the way, is in a term that really, really defines who they were better. And non-dominant is really about power. So you'll hear me use the term non-dominant students.
Okay.
My work with non-dominant students has been to challenge the traditional ways we think about teaching and learning for these students. Most often we take a remedial approach to these students because they don't know English well enough or they haven't had access to high-status courses, et cetera.
Right. Yeah.
In the work that we've done, and we've documented so well, instead of putting students in these environments, we put them in rigorous learning environments that, again, are saturated with opportunities to participate in the very practices that count, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rich literacy practices, saturated with tools and lots of assistance in ways that people can move so quickly in terms of their development in literacy.
So it sounds like we're really trying to recognize afresh the capabilities that students do bring as opposed to the incapabilities that they bring and building on those.
We're certainly building on those, but I think more than that, it's you have to design for it. If you simply want to build on what they do, you're not going to get very far. You really need to have learning far beyond where they are, and then, as I say, design so that you're really doing things that ratchet it up.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take the other approach where I'm simply building on them without really challenging them by helping them engage in new forms of literacy activity, they're not going to move very far.
Yeah, can you give any examples of that?
Yes. For example, many of the migrant students who participated in the UCLA Migrant Student Institute had never written a whole essay. They had never been assigned a whole text. They had varying forms of language facility, right? So rather than focusing on the deficiencies that they had, we were much more interested in understanding the history of the influences on their literacy practices,
mm-hmm.
right? And so rather than, again, putting them in programs that would address those deficiencies, the students were placed in courses in which they read Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Hmm.
They were in science classes in which they were learning, developing scientific literacy by studying the health issues of the migrant community.
Hmm.
They were in courses learning social theory in which they learned conceptually what oppression means and they read about it. And then they read about it and they discussed it and they thought about it. And so students could develop very sophisticated forms of literacy and language.
And what powerful implications for policymakers, teachers, in what they need to be doing with these populations instead of sort of dumbing down the curriculum to be
exactly.
stepping it up.
And, of course, we have wonderful results. The students who participated in that program were very competitive in elite institutions like the University of California.
Hmm.
So we know it was not just a program in which students felt good, but a program that an approach to literacy in which students really did develop powerful literacies that they could leverage, not just at home and in the community and school, but in the academy as well.
Yes, yes. Well, in our final moments here, do you have any additional comments about literacy in the third space, what we still need to find out, what research you're doing now, what your plans are in the future?
Yeah, one of the things that I barely touched in the article that I'm very interested in, that I've been studying the grammar of third spaces, that I have documented that there's something fundamentally different in the grammatical practices of third spaces. Hmm. For example, there were very few direct directives. We rarely heard teachers say, "Betsy, do this."
Hmm.
Instead, the directives were organized around cognitive activity. They were directives like, "Let's think, let's imagine,"
hmm.
right? And we also noted there were lots of modals. So there were lots of if-then clauses and hypotheticals, which really, really organize environments for the future. Environments organized about what's possible, right, rather than delimiting kinds of spaces. And to me, this is fascinating. So
yes.
I'm going to do a lot more work and really trying to pin down what are the grammatical practices of the third spaces. Because I think it'd be really instructive for us to be able to identify what are the various dimensions that help constitute third spaces.
And we'll look forward to seeing your work. This is Dr. Chris Gutierrez from UCLA. Thank you for sharing your insights with us today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, Betsy.
You can find research by Dr. Gutierrez in Reading Research Quarterly, Volume 43, Issue 2, which came out April 2008. Go to our website, voiceofliteracy.org, where you can find a link to this article and additional work done by Dr. Gutierrez. You can also join online discussions of this and other podcast episodes. We invite you to peruse a schedule of upcoming topics and guests, where you can post questions for those guests. This is the Voice of Literacy.
This interview was recorded in the CISLCast studios at the University of Missouri-Columbia.